You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 487.
Try as we might to postpone them, days of reckoning inevitably arrive. Brandon Mull.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we're going to be talking about one of my least favorite subjects, but one of my favorite things to talk about because I feel that it's something that needs to be talked about as much as humanly possible so we can help filmmakers around the world. And that is bad distribution deals. And today's guest has one hell of a story. We have filmmaker Guy Pigden. And Guy has been through the ringer with his first film that got released. And there's a lot of lessons he learned along the way. And he wanted to come on the show and share all of those lessons with you and hopefully help filmmakers around the world avoid some of the same pitfalls that he did. And we also discuss his seven-year feature film, why it took him 7 years to make a feature film, which is another subject I would like to talk about because I'm fascinated by anyone that can hold on to one project for 7 years and keep all the filmmakers with that are working with him on it, the actors, the behind-the-scenes people, everybody together for that long. That is a talent, to say the least. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Guy Pigden. I'd like to welcome to the show Guy Pigden, man. How you doing, Guy?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, Alex. Great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We've been trying to do this for a while now. So I appreciate your patience. It's been very busy at the podcast the last six months.
You're busy, man. You've got a couple of I was planning to do like a joke on Twitter or something where it's like, you know, what does Oliver Stone, Richard Linklater, and Guy Pigden have in common? They're on the
the Indie Film Hustle podcast.
Exactly.
Exactly. So I could say the exact same joke. Like, what do these guys have in common? Yeah, we're just all on the same podcast. That's it. That's where it all ends. The comparisons. But thank you so much for your patience, brother. You reached out to me a while ago. Talking to me about, first of all, one of my favorite topics, which is unfortunately one of my favorite topics, a horrible distribution situation, which we're going to get into, and also a seven-year independent film, which I always love to get into the details of why it takes 7 years to make an independent film, and all of that stuff. But you've been following me for a while. You've been listening to the podcast and stuff. When did you start listening? And then you also, the books had an impact on your career. Tell me a little bit about how you just found me.
Well, that's right. So I was coming from a space. I was sort of finishing up my second feature film, and I'd had my first feature film, which is called I Survived a Zombie Holocaust, which came out in sort of 2015. And it came out around 2015, and it while had a great festival run and, you know, got some great reviews, it did not financially do very well for me for a number of reasons, which you've sort of documented in your podcast. But I was sort of wondering, I was like, is this just the experience of all low-budget indie filmmakers? Is this what we all go through, or is it just me? Am I missing something? Am I missing some key piece of information about how, because this business seems broken to me, that like all of it seemed quite broken in a lot of ways, and how these films were distributed, how these deals were done, and also sort of the cost of making a film versus how much it's actually likely to make back, all of that stuff. And I was asking other filmmakers, and no one seemed to have a good answer. And then I came across your podcast where you sort of really broke down the steps as an indie filmmaker. You sort of broke down how these deals can screw you over. You sort of broke down your own journey with what you were working on with, you know, On the Corner of Ego and Desire and This Is Meg and all that sort of thing. But you really sort of, I guess, put into context and framed everything that I'd been thinking about, that I need to make my filmmaking more of a business. I need to stop thinking like it's just an art form and that I'll just be discovered. We all have to throw away that lottery ticket mentality. All of those things have to, like, you just need a whole shift in perspective, really. If you want to be like, because we can't all be Spielberg, even though we start off imagining that we will be. So how can we have a sustainable career and without maybe those heady heights, but still get to make our films? And so everything that you were talking about just struck this huge chord with me, because it made me sort of really understand, okay, so I'm not crazy, and actually there's this world out there that I need to understand more, and I need to sort of develop these skills, the stuff that you sort of try to educate people on. I need to employ all of that stuff in my filmmaking if I want to continue to grow and develop. And so I was sort of following yours, and also what I found is a lot of the principles of my second feature film, the way I made that is in micro budget and all that sort of thing. Apart from the 7 years, I failed in the quick turnaround, which is again one of your sort of things. Turn it around quickly. I did not do that. But apart from that, a lot of the principles were, you know, I had in mind a lot of these ideas that you actually put into words either in your book or on your podcast. And so that's how I sort of came across you, and have been a sort of loyal follower and subscriber ever since. And you know, what a fantastic thing that you have provided for filmmakers like myself to sort of better understand how we can equip ourselves in this film industry, which, you know, does punch you in the face all the time. As you mentioned, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to keep getting are you going to flinch? Are you going to learn to get your guard up just a little bit to protect yourself? Right. As opposed to just walking straight into those punches
constantly, constantly punches. Yeah. No. And I don't care what you are. You're going to get hit. You're always going to get hit all throughout your career. Hit. Yeah.
Yeah. So those were all things that, you know, really, sort of resonated with me. And that's why I sort of have been listening and reached out. And now my film is out. I thought it would be a great opportunity, hopefully to talk about some of my experiences and how they relate to all of these things that you're, you know, trying to educate people about.
I appreciate that, man. Thank you. Thank you so much for the kind words. Like I've said many times before on the show, sometimes you just don't know what impact they'll have when you do an episode, or I mean, it's just me with a mic
in a room with a Yoda behind me, somewhere in Los Angeles. And you just put it out there and hopefully it really, but look, you're coming from us. Where are you calling from, sir?
New Zealand. Yeah, New Zealand.
Exactly. If you couldn't tell by the accent, New Zealand. It was New Zealand or Australia, but God forbid, God forbid. No, don't do that. Don't do that. It's like calling all Latinos Mexicans, and I'm Latino, so I can say that joke. It just depends on where you are in the country of the U.S. If you're in New York, you're Puerto Rican. If you're in Miami, you're Cuban. And if you're in L.A., you're Mexican. But it doesn't matter. But thank you for that. I'm glad what I do has helped you a lot. And that's, also wanted to kind of dig deeper into what happened with your first film. So before we do that though, how did you even get started? Why did you choose this painful, ridiculous path that we call filmmaking?
I love how you call it a virus, like a sickness. And sometimes you get better and you feel like you've sort of semi-recovered, but no, it always,
always comes back.
And that's always what it's sort of been like for me. So I sort of got into the business. I started off, I was actually lived in London for a couple of years, and I worked as a runner at a production house there. And that was my sort of like break into the industry. I'd already had that sort of that indie filmmaker spirit prior to that. So when I was 16, I made my first short film. I bought like a high 8mm camcorder to shoot it on. I cut it on 2 VCRs, all that sort of thing. And, so that's where I started the idea that I wanted to make films. And I really wanted to make films and tell stories because I have come from my background. My parents, would read stories to me, and my dad is a huge movie fan, and he would sort of talk to me about also how movies were made and directors, not just, hey, check out this film. And so that certainly sparked my interest in sort of filmmaking. I started to do it, and I did this short film when I was 16. And that, again, as soon as we'd shot that, even though it was obviously still quite a painful process even back then, I was like, oh man, I have to do this. And so I went to London and I got a job as a runner. And then as a runner, I also started being a script reader for that same production house there. And I started reading a lot of scripts. And again, I had quite a strong background. The only thing I did well in school at was writing, creative writing. And so I really started as a writer who wanted to be a director. So I read all these scripts and I thought, look, these are coming from, these are coming from agents. These are coming, and I think I can do as well as most of these scripts a couple of hundred scripts I read. I only ever recommended like three. I just sort of thought I could get to this level. And so I started writing my own scripts and developing my own scripts. And some of those, even as a very young, a young writer at like 20, 21, did sort of get some, I think I got one of them to Columbia TriStar in the UK, and it got very favorable coverage. And they're like, look, this is really good. We're not going to make it, but here's a bunch of agents and maybe you can get representation through this script. And I didn't get representation because I didn't have any follow-up scripts. They were like, hey, this is good. This is promising, but what else have you done? And I was sort of like, well, nothing really. And I didn't have that foresight and that sort of thing to just start writing like crazy and just go, here's five others, and really get the ball rolling then. But it did sort of, again, give me some confidence that, hey, I can write and I'm a good writer, and hopefully I can transition to being a writer and a director. And so I came back to New Zealand. I started making stuff again, just making stuff for my friends. A lot of those friends that I still work with to this day, started shooting stuff with a more of an education in film. I've never been to film school or anything like that, but I had a better knowledge and a better understanding of kind of the business and the way things worked a little bit more, and obviously story and structure and all those things from being a script reader. And I started to get actual paid work as a writer. So I developed a few different things that sort of didn't get produced, but sort of took me in again. It's like, okay, I'm getting paid for writing now, so I know that I must be doing something right, and I must be on a certain level if, you know, this can happen. And what happens in New Zealand is we have a government body called the New Zealand Film Commission, and they provide essentially grants for films to make movies over here. So very, very, very different to, you know, the US and, you know, the studio system and all that sort of thing. But essentially these grants given out to make films, and they hope that these films will sort of break out. And I had, you know, made many submissions to the Film Commission prior to this one, but I made a submission for a new scheme around this time as I was still making my own projects, which was what would become I Survived the Zombie Holocaust. So it was this zombie horror comedy. And it was for this new initiative called the Escalator Scheme. And the Escalator Scheme was essentially they give 250,000 New Zealand dollars to an up-and-coming filmmaker who has not made a feature film. So you couldn't have already made a feature film. And they give you that money, and through a series of steps, you are then given the money to make the film. But you have to sort of do all the pre-production first. So you have to, without anything. So you write the script, you do all the pre-production, you do the budget, you do everything, and you present that to them. Then they sort of narrow it down to another group. You go back, you redo all that stuff, and you get given the money. And so we were, you know, it went from sort of like maybe 20 or 30 or 40 teams down to, I think, 12 teams. And so four of those 12 teams were going to be picked. And fortunately, we were one of those four nice. Teams that were picked to make that thing. And that was back in 2010, the end of 2010, early 2011, when that sort of initial thing happened. And there was a couple of rules around it, but, you know, one of them was that you kind of had to start production within 6 months of getting the grant, which we did. The other thing is that you couldn't get any extra money. So you couldn't get more financing or try and get more people on board or people to kind of top that up somehow. You just had your 250,000 and that was it. And so we were given that funding, and we sort of shot in 2011, early 2011. And then it was another sort of 3 years before the film actually came out, which we can get into.
Of course, of course. You were doing posts, you were doing film festivals, you were getting it out there in other ways.
That's right.
So I'd love to dive into, man. Okay, so what happened with I Survived a Zombie Holocaust with this distribution situation? Like you told me that there's a horror story here, and we'd love to share those here at the show to help and educate filmmakers. So what happened exactly?
Well, I mean, a lot of it comes down to not understanding, you know, a lot of it comes down to ignorance on our behalf as sort of filmmakers. And then, you know, there wasn't something, you know, this was back 2014, 2015, this is before you'd really blown the lid off this kind of this practice, right? And I think there's also an inherent fear from all us filmmakers. If we speak out, like if we say something about, we'll never get another opportunity, and not just from them, but from any other people that know them. And so there's this, oh, well, I can't say to anyone, you know, this, you know, they screwed us, because we'll just get screwed more. It will only negatively impact us. And so we all stay quiet about what happened. But for us, we sort of, I mean, there was a few issues, but, you know, just again, we're talking about, I'm from a very small town, and although and I've been to London and I've done all this stuff and I've done everything I could possibly do to educate myself about filmmaking, there's actually very few books on the post-production and finishing and business at the end. Like yours is really one of the only, and certainly one of the first. And so I didn't understand. Like, I didn't even understand, okay, what's a good film festival? Why is there A, B, and C? I didn't understand. I got into a good film festival, I was like, great. I got into a bad film festival, I was like, great. I didn't understand the difference. I didn't understand why one might be more important to go to than the other. I didn't understand about festival fees or anything. I was just randomly submitting to random things, and if they got in, cool. All of which then sort of leads to obviously, when you have a successful festival run, you start getting approached by sales agents and distributors. And we were approached by a sales agent. And again, there's a lot of things that sort of reel you in, because they're playing on your naivety to a high degree.
And also your dreams. Don't forget. They love
your dreams.
They love to dangle the carrot like, hey, this could be the one. Spielberg, is Mr. Spielberg, come this way. Yeah.
And so the first thing they did is, oh, we haven't even finished the film yet, but we just wanted to come out of the screening and say we love it and we think it's amazing and we know we want to sign it straight away. So automatically, wow, you want to sign us? Oh, that's...
They like me.
Like me. This huge company. And again, we were banking on the fact that they were big. They have all this huge catalog of films. So, well, they must be good because they're big, which is, again, not necessarily at all true. And so we were definitely caught up in that because we had multiple offers. This wasn't the only offer, but it also wasn't the only bad offer, you know?
Right.
And so there was a lot of this sort of back and forth over it. But essentially, we sort of did all the things wrong that we normally that you have talked about. So
right.
Marketing sales cap was atrociously high.
What was it?
I don't think I could get into specifics, okay. But I can definitely tell you that it was, well, I'll just put it this way. It was over $50,000.
Okay.
Then, you know, there was just a lot of things, but there was a lot of smaller details in that deal that just meant that there was very unlikely, or that's not true. I suppose if it made millions of dollars, great. Of course you're going to see that money come back to you.
Maybe. Yeah. Look, Forrest Gump, according to Paramount, Forrest Gump is still not making any money. So
exactly. And so, but even in that marketing, there was no accounting for that marketing, as in there's no way for me to go, well, can I see where you spent that money? Because they didn't spend that money. They didn't spend any of that money. They didn't spend, I would go as far as to say they, you know, spent, I'm sure, less than $1,000. But also a marketing sales cap is really, to me, more for your distributor than it is a sales agent. What does a sales agent need?
Wait a minute. This was a sales agent? You haven't even gotten to the distributor yet?
We haven't even got to the distributor yet.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry.
So you see what I'm – yeah, exactly.
It hurts. Okay.
But that was the problem, is we didn't even understand the distinction between the sales agent and the distributor. Because now my first question would be like, why do you need $50,000? What are you doing with that? I'm providing you all these deliverables so you don't have to make anything. So you're now just giving it to a distributor who will do anything that is required. What is this marketing, you know, what is this marketing sales cap for? And so that was a huge, huge thing. And then there was like other little things built in because, you know, it's also, okay, so we got to recoup that $50,000, but we're also going to take our percentage from that before. So it's not $50,000. So we're taking money for ourselves while we bring back that however much money it is. So we're not just bringing, so it's not just $50,000. It's actually more like $70,000 or $80,000 because we're taking 20 or 30% or whatever it is out as we go. So then it's like, okay, so it doesn't have to make, it has to make $90,000 before we see any money. And then there was just this whole, like what I sort of heard, you know, subsequent, you know, because you also try and speak to filmmakers before you make these deals, but you often speak to filmmakers who have just made a deal with that sales agent. You don't speak to someone that has that's 3 years in, you know. And also they may be reluctant to tell you, hey, you know, because of this whole thing, because, you know, thank God for, you know, Indie Film Hustle to, you know, to say like, hey, you know, this is a predatory thing that's going on. It's terrible. It's got to stop and it's happening and we're going to shine a light on it. And I think it's just very, very important. So around that deal, around that that sort of marketing cap was our big thing. But I also sort of then heard rumors later on that this wasn't even and in terms of, you know, what they made back is always just whatever that marketing Sal's cap is, like almost exactly whatever that is.
Magically.
So magically. When you look at that, you go, okay, so actually what they're doing is they're getting all these sort of lower budget, you know, horror films, genre films, and they're doing exactly the same thing to all these different first-time filmmakers, and they're using that pot of money to actually pay for their bigger films and maybe treat those slightly, you know, better. But so essentially they had never had any intention of making any more sales than that. All they wanted is that guaranteed first chunk of money from a big bunch of places. So, you know, this is for television and all that sort of thing.
And they're selling different territories out in different deals here and there. Yeah.
Like big territories. They just make those sales and then they don't even push it again. It's like, it's not even part of their thing. It's just, we just needed that $50,000 that we don't have to pay back, or that, you know, $70,000, $80,000, whatever we have to make, we get that. And we don't do anything more because it doesn't make sense for us to start really giving much back to the filmmakers. We only deal in those big deals up front with our certain people that we have, and then we sort of walk away and find the next filmmaker and do the same thing, find the next naive filmmaker and do the same thing. And so really that was, you know, the hardest part for me is that we'd been on this journey for 5 years. You know, I had past the $250,000 that we were given, I had actually invested heaps of my own money into, you know, getting that finished. I'd shot pickups and I'd been living this thing for so long trying to get it made and get it done. And then just to watch kind of other people like slowly collect money and then have none of it come back. And we also had there was also lots of other things going on. So, you know, one of the other things that they did is that they said, you know, essentially you have to, like, when you give all your deliverables over, as you know, there's sort of something in the contract that states once you've received these certain things, that's confirmed, right? It's done. You know, you're good. You have no more obligations. Well, in the contract, one of the obligations was a letter that said, we have delivered all of these things. Right. So just a letter that says you have delivered these things. We delivered those things. We sent a letter to them, not worded in that official way, just worded in a different way. And then sort of a couple of years into our thing, when we realized that essentially we'd been screwed, we had one loophole, which was if it hadn't made a certain amount by a certain time, we could ask to get it back. it was like the one good thing that we sort of put in the contract. And so I was like, cool, we need to exercise this right now. And so we go, cool, we'd like to exercise this. And they go, oh, no, you haven't handed in all your deliverables. And we're like, well, what are you talking about? You've been selling the film for 2 years. You've got all the deliverables. We've confirmed it. You know, there's been absolutely no issues. And they go, oh, yeah, but if you look in the contract, you'll see that we need this confirmation letter to confirm officially that we've received those. And so that then goes, so they go, cool. So then we sent that letter and they go, okay, the contract starts from now officially. And you could absolutely
what happens to all that money that they've been making?
Well, yeah, is that null and void because we hadn't officially delivered the film? You know, this is the thing, and this is what I hate the most about the whole thing is, obviously, you could go after them with a lawyer and say, but you know, they know that, well, we're going to bring our lawyer and however much it's going to cost you is not going to be worth it. And also, we know you're a poor filmmaker because we've taken all your money. So we know that you can't get a lawyer. We know that you can't afford a lawyer. And we'll just happily sit back and do our thing and, you know, kind of keep your film in purgatory. And that's kind of what happened with that thing. And it definitely came from, you know, I'd love to say it was absolutely a predatory situation. And it was absolutely what you talk about, so often here on the podcast. But it was also, you know, that ignorance and naivety that is exploited when you're a first-time filmmaker. And that's where we were sort of at with a lot of that, with a lot of those negotiations, is we just did not understand, you know, how this could go wrong.
And now you also had, so you mean to tell me you had a sales agent and you had a distribution company.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So the sales agent then was the issue. We do have, you know, it did then go on to distribution.
Oh, it stopped at the sales agent.
But the sales agent was the one that did this deal that was, you know, And so you also have to put it into, again, that perspective of like, what is a sales agent marketing? What are they like? Yes, they're taking your film. Well, what does that involve? You know, if you've got all your deliverables.
They're obviously buying giant billboards near highways. They're exactly. they're spending at least $10,000 in ads on television and Facebook, you know, targeting your niche audience. Obviously they're doing all of this because the ROI makes all the sense in the world. It is terrible. I'm sorry that you had to go through that. But you learned, look, you know, you've been listening to me long enough. You've read a lot of my stuff. You know, I've been through some stuff myself. with the mafia, with Hollywood, and all sorts of different things that I've gone through. So, but when you come out of those kind of events, you are a lot stronger and you're a lot smarter. You've got that armor, that shrapnel that I talk about so much. You've got shrapnel all over you, brother. I could smell it. I could smell it across the world, sir. I could smell that shrapnel's there. But hopefully that story that you just told will help other people listening right now. Go, oh, wait a minute, I might be getting screwed on this, or damn it, I just got screwed. Something has to change, man. I don't know what that is yet. I don't know how that's going to work. Trust me, there's not a day that goes by that I'm not thinking of how I can crack the nut myself. I'm like, how can I do something? You know, how can a small podcaster, a humble podcaster, you know, with a Yoda behind him, you know, do something more than what I've already been doing? Because something's got to change, man. Something's got to change. And it's been going around, man. It's been going around since Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin's days. I mean, it's literally been going along that long. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is, I know that my story isn't new. I know that, you know, we're sort of talking about something that happens a lot, but it's still happening. And I'm still, you know, even my experiences, people have come to me and said, hey, you know, what's your experience? And I've told them my experience. And then I sort of go, so what do you do? Oh, well, we signed with them. Well, you know,
because they don't have any other options. They don't know any better. And they're like, well, this is the only guy or gal who was willing to date me. So because
exactly,
and it's an abuse, and it's an abusive relationship. So let's put it in that it's an abusive relationship, but this is the only person that loves me. So I guess I'm just going to go with them because you don't believe that there's another option out there for you.
And I also think that we all as filmmakers, you go, oh, well, you got screwed, guy. You know why? Because your film was just not good enough to make that all that money that you thought you were going to make. You know, that we sort of as naive young filmmakers, we go, oh, you got screwed, but my film's going to make $1 million. The reality is that, you know,
that's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen to me.
That's just exactly. That's not going to happen to me because I don't. But it's like, just consider that your film isn't going to make $1 million. Consider that you just want some good returns on your film. And when do you want to start making back money from that? Do you want to start make? Does your film have to make, you know, $70,000-$80,000 before you see a cent? Or do you want to really think carefully about this? And also, you know, the world is changing, right? Streaming has changed everything. Even the way that the idea of like, well, we need all this money for marketing. Well, why? Because if you put something up on, you know, Amazon or Netflix or wherever, it's like, you don't need all that marketing. The marketing is done. The viewership is already there, you know. Now, I'm not saying marketing isn't super important, but it's not for a sales agent or necessarily or distributor to have to spend. You know, that comes when the film is out.
But just so you know, I've known a lot of sales reps and producers reps. I've never heard of one ever spending money for marketing. Yeah. Maybe they'll pay something to get a trailer done. Maybe they'll get a poster made if the poster's not done. But to like buy ads somewhere?
Doesn't make sense.
I can't even compare. I mean, the only thing that would make sense is if they bought like, you know, a front page ad on Hollywood Reporter during AFM, you know, or that kind of ad buy. That's a big maybe, but for a sales producer to drop 30 grand out of their, because it's out of their pocket, you know, for a front, it's not like it's magic money. That's money that they're putting up and hoping to recoup.
Yeah.
It doesn't make business unless they think that that $30,000 is going to be an easy sell. Why would they spend that money? They're, generally, when a sales rep picks up a film or a distributor picks up a film, if they give you an MG, which is rare nowadays, but even if they, let's say you got a deal for 50 grand, that's your MG, you would have probably been like jumping out the window, like, oh my God, I got 50,000 for the MG. And that's just the start of the massive amounts of money that I'm going to make. It's just massive amounts. First of all, you'll probably never see another dime, first of all. But the distributor knows that with two phone calls, with little effort, they'll be able to sell this film in certain territories based on their relationships or automatic output deals that a lot of them they have, that they'll make that money instantly. But what I've heard happen is like, let's say your marketing cap is 75 grand or 100 grand.
Yeah.
The moment they hit that 100,000, they literally stop selling it because they don't want to deal with you anymore. So they're like, oh, sorry. No. And they will just stop because they're like, we got our 100 out. We're done. And the filmmaker, and then they hold on to it for the next 7 years. Yes. And every single time, and then because you've signed a horrible deal. And then after that, anytime a new streaming service comes out or a new cable station in Germany opens up and they're like, we need a lot of content, they'll sell the whole library and license the whole library as a package deal. And by the time you try to do the math of how much your movie is worth or not, it's gone. It's gone. It is such a ridiculous business. The only reason that we are still able to do what we do or the business survives is because there's a fresh new crop of films and filmmakers coming in monthly. And these distributors and these predators know that. So they know that they don't have to build a relationship with you because there's 30 more of you right around the corner who are willing to give up. And I've actually consulted filmmakers in, when I was coaching them and consulting them on projects where we know we're not going to go with the distributor. And some of them are big name distributors who will remain nameless, but I know that their deals suck. And the deal that they send over suck. I'm like, okay, we're not going with them. We're going to go with these other guys, but let's push them and see how far we can go. And we'll start asking for things like, you know, accounting on marketing and, or let's drop the marketing cap or, you know, give a little bit more MG up front or add, if you go bankrupt, that the movie automatically goes back to you as opposed to sitting in arbitration for the next, you know, 5 years and you can't do anything with the movie. And I saw it go back and forth once. And then afterwards, they're like, yeah, we're done. Thank you. They didn't want to negotiate anymore because they're like, this obviously is going to be a headache. The film's not worth it. There's 40 more around the corner.
And also they know, they go, okay, this person actually knows what they're talking about. Therefore, we cannot use our regular exploitative tactics with them and we can't make our, you know, 80, 100K up front that we want off them before we leave. So yeah, we'll just go to the next. And there's always another person because, you know, we don't all listen to Indie Film Hustle, you know, yet. And so, but I think the most important thing is we have to talk about it. We have to share these stories and we have to kind of converse with other filmmakers, you know, and really say, look, just, you know, you need to take it to more experienced people. When you've got those deals on the table, you need to take it to more experienced people to comment on it. And like, you know, even paying like, you know, and we did have a lawyer and all that stuff. Look at this deal. Mm-hmm. And we also, you know, crazily, we had the film commission, the body, you know, the person there looked at this deal and was like, yeah, looks good. And that still blows my mind.
But they don't know. They don't know. They don't know any of this. You need to have like, I say it in the book. I'm like, don't get Uncle Bob, the real estate attorney, to look at this because he won't know what to look for. That's why having a consulting session with me for a half an hour could save you $500,000. And that's actually happened. It's actually happened with me or with many. There's many good people out there that do what I do as far as consulting and helping filmmakers with their projects. I literally had a filmmaker reach out. I think he was on the show at one point. He said, like, dude, you saved me $500,000 because of this deal was so bad. And I went with this other deal and I was able to control my rights and all this kind of stuff. And it was literally a half an hour or hour consultation that I gave him. And I should charge obscenely much more than I do, but I just want to help people. And that's why I put together that course, that 6 hour distribution course on every little detail and trick that they use to screw you over. That was a new one. That paper, that letter thing, that's a completely new level of scum, scummery.
Exactly. And I
And I,
you know, sort of recently or not that recently, but I sort of said, so, you know, the deal's coming up. This is the official letter that would like to terminate our agreement and get the rights back at this time. And they were like, oh, thanks, but you know how you didn't send through that letter? So actually it's an extra 2 years, you know, because of the letter, you know. And part of me wants to totally lose my shit and you know, go after them with everything I have. But the other part of me has to be a bit more zen about it. And I just hope, like I said, I just hope that we can share these stories and we can stop people from getting into these positions. You just do not want to be the kind of the low budget indie horror, which they always do kind of, they always do sell a certain amount and they always can make money for people. And so you don't want to be that person that's bought up by this big sales agent or distributor and used. Essentially they suck the life out of you. Because they don't just take that film from you. They take that opportunity for the money you make from that film to develop your next film. And that's a really key thing, is that, you know, you can't just spend 5 years on something and then get absolutely nothing to show for it and have no, and then it's like, cool, well, I'm rebuilding from square one now. I'm back to, you know, obviously I know a lot more, I've got a lot more experience, but you know, you've taken the opportunity for me to develop my craft and continue on. And obviously they just don't care. So that's a very good, I guess, lesson that I learned and through this podcast and through your books has sort of made me really be much more aware of that side of it. But, you know, the key to contracts is transparency, you know, transparency. Yes. And all the things, you know, if they're giving you a marketing, well, I need to know where that marketing is going, and I need it in the contract that I see everything that is being spent, and maybe that I even approve certain things, you know. And even these marketing caps is like, you know, really, how much are they going to be spending on your low budget indie film? If we're all making indie films, are they really dropping, you know, $30,000 on your marketing your independent film? Like, forget about it. They're spending a tiny fraction of that and getting a lot back with these guaranteed places that they always take these to that they know they can sell. And it is borderline criminal, but you know,
well, it's definitely immoral. And the problem it is that, well, first of all, they're destroying lives. They're literally destroying people's lives. I've seen it time and time again. But what's the most disgusting part about this is that it is just so inherent inside of the distribution world that this is just the way business is done. And it's like they don't even think twice. They're like, oh, sorry, you're going to have to do another 2 years because you didn't do that one little thing. Yeah. And you're just like, wow, man. Like, it just rolls off their tongue. And I've said this on the show before, and I'll say it again. The same thing that happened with Me Too, where the casting couch was business as usual. It was a running joke in the business. It was in movies that people were like, oh, if you want that part, you're going to have to go on the casting couch. Like, you know, sleeping with the producer or the director. So that was a thing throughout Hollywood's history. It was just business as usual till finally some people started standing up. And now, thank God, that is not the way business is done as usual. That moment is yet to happen in this space, because it is still, I feel like, a financial raping of the independent film community. Yeah. Without question, it is a physical abuse that the whole distribution infrastructure is doing to independent filmmakers and the whole community in general. And again, I've said this again, it's not everybody. They're not all predators. No. They're not. They're, I know good people. I've worked with good people. I've talked about them. I've had them on the show. There are good people out there trying to help filmmakers, but a lot of them aren't. And one thing people listening have to understand, it is harder now to make a dollar with an independent film than it has ever been in the history of filmmaking, for independent filmmaking specifically. It is really, really tough. And even with people who know what they're doing, it's tough. Yeah. So walk in with that, walk in humble to this, brother. Like you were saying, like, you got to walk in humble, like, oh, I'm going to be the next Spielberg. Like, I had that conversation. You read it in my book.
Yeah.
Like, in Shooting for the Mob, I was just like, it's my time. It's obviously going to happen to me. When are they going to recognize my genius? Back up the truck with the cash and in my house in the Hollywood Hills, and let's go have lunch with Spielberg and Cameron. Like, how is, like, that was the mentality so many filmmakers have. You've got to walk in humble, very humble, because if you don't walk in humble, it will humble you.
Yes, as it has done many, many times.
and by the way, we'll continue to do to you throughout your career. It will humble you. Look, Jeff Katzenberg, arguably one of the more successful producers in history, you know, with Disney and DreamWorks. And, you know, he worked with, you know, partnered with Spielberg and Geffen to create DreamWorks, and arguably a legend. He just got humbled by Quibi. He thought he could come out. He thought he could come out. He thought he could come out. And he's like, you know what? We're going to throw a billion bones in this. We're going to do this, and we're going to be the next big thing, and pop, pop, pop. And you know what? It didn't work. And a lot of people lost a lot of money, and he was humbled. But I do give him credit for getting up to the plate and taking a swing. I don't think he walked in thinking that he was the end all be all. I don't know the man. I don't know how it worked, but at least he gave it a shot. But look, a man of literally a legend in our business, an absolute icon in our business, humbled. It happens to every big director. Every big director has a flop. Hey, Steven Spielberg, but he had 1941.
He did.
1941. I still love the movie, but it did not do well in the box office, and he was humbled. If you don't walk in humble to every project, you promise you will get humbled at one point or another in your life. And it happens to everybody.
And I think that's also a really important distinction to make, is that it is very hard to make a good film. It is even harder to make a good film and then have that good film, especially in the indie world, find its audience. It's not even just making a good film. You got to make a good film, and then you have to take that one step further and connect to that audience. And that is something that costs money, you know, and marketing and all that stuff, which is, again, we just think, hey, we'll just make this film. It'll be so good that so we don't have to worry about the good, bad thing, because it's going to be so good.
It's obvious. And two, genius.
The audience will just connect to it. I'll find my audience. And that was another thing, is that we, you know, with Zombie Holocaust, we had, you know, like I said, it was on Showtime for years. People were saying, hey, I saw your film. You know, it was, you know, pirated, like, you know, over, you know, millions of times. Sometimes it would pop up on YouTube, and then you'd catch it at about 300,000 views on YouTube and go, can we please take this down? So it's not that people weren't watching it, but even that did not truly connect. Like, I could not connect to my zombie fan base. Like, people that love zombie films still don't necessarily know that that film exists. I couldn't connect to my audience. I couldn't, I didn't have that sort of that marketing push or that clout or that sort of even that grassroots thing to really join those dots to make it a huge success in that way. And these are all things that we don't think about when we're sort of starting out. So, but you have to. And like you said, like I think about this when I made my second feature, Older, which was a micro budget film. In 2013 is when I started that film. And in 2013, if you made a feature film, it was still an achievement. People were still like, hey, that's pretty, oh, you made that. You just did that. You sort of put it all together. Oh, that's impressive. And in 2021, that's cool. It's like, cool. Well, I think my neighbor did that. I'm pretty sure he's put together a feature film.
And I think, he has Eric Roberts in it. So, yeah, sorry, Eric, I apologize. I do love you, man. Best of the Best was awesome, bro. I'm sorry.
that the technology has made it more accessible and easier to do, which has muddied the waters to the point where, you know, how you finding those quality indie titles now, because it's not just that they're not just sticking out anymore.
Right.
They're in this whole sea of other stuff. And so, you know, that is another challenge that we have to think about and face and sort of work on if we want to connect.
No question. And if anyone listening out there thinks they're going to make an independent film and your audience is going to find you, I also have some land to sell you or a bridge to sell you as well. Some swamp land in Florida. It's fantastic. I mean, it just that's mentality from 1992, 93, 94, when someone could find a Clerks. Someone could find a Brothers McMullen. Do you think Brothers McMullen, if it showed up today, would make a dime? I talked to Ed, not to be a douchey LA guy who's dropping names, but when we had Ed on the show, I asked him, like, did you think? He's like, probably not. probably not. It would be so difficult to get any sort of attention for a film like that in today's world. So it was about timing. And Mariachi too, you know, when Robert eventually shows up on the show, which he will one day, when Robert shows up on the show, I'll go, do you think Mariachi would have a chance today? Like, truly, truly, do you think, you know, Mariachi, not that it's not, it has nothing to do with the quality of the film.
No.
It's the marketplace. Can it find its audience? So I hope people listening take your story wholeheartedly and and trust me, you've got to be a special kind of person, especially depending on what age you're at, to really look at yourself and go, maybe I'm not the next Spielberg. Because I promise you, every big guy that you think, or every big director you followed in the last 30 years, all probably thought, if they were younger or another generation from Spielberg, mm-hmm. thought were the next Spielberg. And they ended up being something else, like the Finchers of the world and the Nolans and even Cameron. Cameron was inspired by Lucas and he went on to do his own thing. But everyone aims for the masters. Everybody wants to draw like Picasso or Van Gogh. Yeah. If you pick up a paintbrush, you're like, it has to be Picasso or Van Gogh. Yeah, we'd love to get to that place, but the hard reality and the truth is you're never going to get to that. You more than likely will never get to that place because it's impossible to get to that place because there's only one Van Gogh, period. But you can get to your Van Gogh place, whatever that place might be. It could be right there next to him, or it could be just making a living as a painter and loving your life. And that's okay. You don't have to be rich and famous. You don't have to be Tarantino to be a successful filmmaker. I know filmmakers have had on the show who direct all the time and just make their movies and aim it at their audiences and they make a good living and they're not living up in the Hollywood Hills, but every day they wake up and they get to do what they love to do. And I think that is the success. That is the dream. Not making millions of dollars and making a Marvel movie, which, by the way, as I always say, Kevin Feige, I'll take the meeting. but that's not the only definition of success. And I think hopefully in this show, I've put that out there enough that filmmakers, especially younger filmmakers, will understand that. And I'm glad you've shared this story with us. But before we go, I do want to touch upon the 7 years it took you to make your next film, Older. What happened?
After the experience with the zombie film, and to be honest, I was still going through it because in 2013, I was still wrapping up the post-production on the zombie film and I was still sort of chipping away at that. But I sort of was like, okay, cool. I've made this kind of, and you know, again, one of my other mistakes is that I tried to make a film that should have cost several million dollars for $250,000. So I was not working within my budget in terms of like, so that made every single scene, every single thing harder because essentially I was asking much more of the resources that I had. So I had to be, you know, much cleverer about my approach, which I wasn't always, but all of that just made it extremely difficult. And I thought, okay, look, I just want to do a walkie-talkie film. I want to do a film, you know, that's much more modest in scope and scale, that is, you know, something that I love, which is, you know, who you've had on the show, Richard Linklater Films. But I was thinking about Before Sunset, Sunrise, just people talking and hanging out, real relationships, all that sort of stuff. I loved, you know, those early Woody Allen films as well that sort of dealt with that sort of thing. And so I wanted to do something like that, which was just as far away from zombies and exploding heads and sort of gore and all those sort of things that I'd been sort of, you know, knee deep in. I wanted to just do the opposite. And that was really my inspiration for Shooting Older, just do a real relationship drama, because I love those films as well. I'm not just a horror guy. And so I sort of set about, we did some crowdfunding, and this, again, this was kind of before crowdfunding was cool. This is when it was sort of in its infancy, like not everyone was doing it. We did an Indiegogo and we raised, I think about $5,000. I also have, with my production partner, Harley Neville, we have this successful YouTube channel. We used some money from our YouTube channel, and we kind of pulled all those resources, and we were just like, it's going to be 3 weeks. I'm going to shoot it. I'm going to have it all done within a year.
I'm sure that's the way it worked out.
And we shot it. We shot it in 3 weeks, but with the idea that we'd shoot like 80% of it. So that 80% was like the hardest part of the film. We'd do in 3 weeks, and then we'd pick up some of the little bits that I didn't have time for, that 20% over weekends following on from that. And that was always the way I'd do it. And I was sort of inspired because, you know, at that time, 2013, the 5D Mark III had come out, and the Mark II. And I'd shot some pickups for the zombie film on the Mark II. And I was like, holy cow, this camera can almost replicate what I had with a crew of 20 or 30 on the zombie film. But it's just me and another guy and some photography lenses. And so, you know, obviously it was this kind of revolutionary moment for indie filmmakers at the time, with that type of gear, to get this kind of this shallow depth of field look is really what we're talking about. And so I was like, okay, we'll get that camera. We'll use that. I had a friend over in Australia who's a director of photography. He actually flew over for 3 weeks to do that shoot. And we sort of really went back to basics with it. Super small crew, way more like, you know, we're talking three or four people, and keeping it that small scale, because it gives you a lot of freedom. You know, it gives you a lot more freedom sometimes when we're not all thinking about our marks and, oh, the focus puller is a bit out today. You know, all of those things that kind of sometimes stagnate a shoot when you have a big team and a big crew. You can just go back to the basics and just, it's all about the story. It's all about the performances, and it's about character and relationships and all that sort of thing. So we shot that. We continued to do those pickups straight afterwards. But what happened is that, I kind of then got bogged back down in creating the deliverables and post work for the zombie film, and then the promotion and marketing of the zombie film. So from that sort of end of 2013 into 2014 into 2015, I was really very preoccupied with getting my first feature out there, and sort of didn't really start back up editing older until sort of, you know, 2016-ish, really. And then I sort of had some more ideas about, maybe I want to change this. Maybe I want to adjust some things, because, A, I'm a perfectionist, and, you know, you have a love for Stanley Kubrick. I have a love for Stanley Kubrick. Mm-hmm. It's not right until it's right. And so when you have such a small crew and such a small team, and you're on good terms with all of them, one of the big benefits you have is you can go, you know what, the scene isn't quite right. Let's go back and redo it. Let's shoot it again. So I sort of did a little bit of that. I did a little bit of rewriting of some sections, which again could have been avoided had I done more thorough work on the script to begin with. You know, I was sort of rewriting after the fact instead of rewriting beforehand and saving all that time to shoot it twice, you know. So I wouldn't say that, like, essentially the majority of the film was still that 2013 shoot, but there was these bits from 2014 and 2015 and 2016 and actually all the way up to 2019.
How did you were the star of this as well, right?
Yes.
How did you keep your aging?
I'm aging rapidly.
As filmmakers too, we do not age well.
I always joke about this too, is that filmmaking is like staring into the deadlights in It, you know, when it turns everything gray. That's filmmaking. It ages you. Years and years.
I'm 25 years old. I'm 25 years old. Look at me. You're like what, 17? I mean, look at you.
Exactly. I'm only 17. So it was a bit of a problem. I went from having hair that was graying to gray hair, so I had to keep dyeing my hair for it. I also had to maintain a certain weight as well, because I'd sort of got in shape because I knew I was doing these sex scenes and stuff like that, and I was like, okay, I want to look good on camera, obviously. And so that was a struggle. So it was a battle, Alex. It was very tricky.
At least it kept you healthy. You look better than you ever did for 7 years. And now you've completely let yourself go. So that's fine.
That's right. And now I'm totally different. And I'm like, look, now that time can catch back up. So it was a little bit of a challenge to keep that continuity. And we had actresses, you know, with hair twice the length it was, you know, and they were like, well, I'm not cutting it again for this film, guys. You better figure out a way to dress my hair so it doesn't look like this. And so there was lots of issues like
God
that.
Bless
there was
you,
also
man.
Some of that, like the house that we'd originally filmed in, we no longer lived there, so we couldn't film there anymore. So we had to go back in, and there was all sorts of stuff.
All of this is the insanity. This is the definition of insanity of being a filmmaker. It is, and it's wonderful, it's beautiful, and it's just destructive and terrifying all at the same time. It can be. It wasn't in this case, but it can be.
Yes.
Imagine if you would have put not 8,000, but 80,000, and you would have mortgaged your house, and then all of a sudden you can't pay the rent, and all of a sudden you lose your house because of this film. And I've heard these stories, man. So, but at least you were smart enough to go, you know, let's keep this micro.
Keep it small.
The worst thing is I'm going to not have to, I can't eat those French fries. That kind of look good.
And the other battle too was just the edit, because I also edited it myself. And I got busy with other projects. You know, if someone would come on and say, hey, can you shoot this web series? It's like, okay, cool. Well, that's, you know, the next 4 months is me working on that web series, you know. Are we gonna shoot this other little short film? Okay, well, let me do that. And so I certainly got into having to put a pause on the film to do these other projects, which I was very grateful for, because, you know, sort of earlier, maybe in 2013, I wasn't being asked to do those things. So, you know, it was a progression in one respect, but it was also holding up the film. But I think that, you know, that's, again, something that if I had a do-over and I could afford it, I wouldn't edit it myself, because
it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. In fact, to me, that is the most time intensive part of the filmmaking. You think it's the shoot. Maybe you think it's the writing of it. You think all those things. But as soon as you're in that edit room and you're chipping away and you're looking at take six and you're like, oh, well, I actually need a little bit from here and a little bit from take one, a little bit from take, two.
Brutal.
It is. It's a grind. And so all of those things, because also, you know, I also work other jobs as well. I'm not just a full-time filmmaker. Sadly, people aren't paying me enough to, you know, just be directing or freelancing. I do camera stuff and edits for other people and write for other people. So all of those things kind of just would put a pause on the film until we sort of finally got to the end in sort of 2020. And sometimes you also, like, I'd been through it once. I'd been through that whole process. So I was a little bit more patient and understanding of that process. And really the focus was obviously trying to make the film as good as it could be. But that 7 years goes by pretty quick.
I tell you, like, I just woke up and I'm 46 now. Like, last night I just got into film school. Like, I mean, it was just like, I still remember, like, just walking onto the soundstage for the first time going, oh, this is where I'm going to bring in the crane here, and we're going to get the techno over here, and we're going to do this. And none of that I could afford. Richard Linklater said something that was such a profound statement. And I've heard a few people tweet it out after that interview came out. He says that our skill set eventually catches up with our ideas.
Mm.
Because when you're young and when you're starting out, you've got massive ideas. You're like, I can do Avengers. Yeah, I could do this or that. But the skill set, the craft takes time to catch up. And he was the first to admit it. Like when he did Slacker, he, you know, there was things and every movie that he kept doing from Dazed and Confused and so on, he got better and better and better. And I even, you know, told him that. And he's like, yeah, you know, after the fourth or fifth, I'm solid. Like after the fourth or fifth movie, I was like, you might not like my movies, but you can't argue that I can make movies. You know, that I can finish a movie. See, like it took me about four or five movies to get that under my belt and I'm solid. You can't argue with that. At the beginning, you could have like, is this guy even going to be able to make this thing work? It takes time to get that craft, to catch up to those ideas. And it's patience, brother. It's patience. But listen, I have a couple questions to ask all my guests, and you probably know these since you listen to the show.
I am.
You should. Then you'd be able, you better be prepared, sir. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Well, to be honest, because you know we've mentioned a couple of these, and I actually did try and write down a couple of these things, but you know, for starters, forget the lottery ticket mentality, as you say all the time, and think about long-term sustainability. View your films as a brand and business as well as an artistic endeavor. So that's something that
I would
definitely throw out there. I would also say, you know, don't assume that people will recognize your talent. So focus on connecting with an audience that appreciates it. But stop assuming that I'm a genius and, you know, what I do will just be at that level that I want it to be with all my, you know, all those greats that I look up to. So, you know, you got to shift that mindset a lot. So those are the things I take away. I mean, to my younger self, I'd say, look, man, don't be depressed. But it is going to take a lot longer than you think. Obviously
it's going to take and again, I'll go back to Rick, cause he said this, another quote, he's like, it's going to take twice as long as you think, and it's going to be twice as hard.
Yes. And that is
so great.
And, you know, I know that I can't remember who it was that said it takes 10 years to become an overnight success. Well, maybe I think it takes 20 years to become an overnight success.
It depends on your path, man. Look, it all depends on the path you walk. Some people hit it out of the park, like Robert.
That's true.
With El Mariachi, and he was given a gift. And a lot of these guys I've had on the show were given gifts, like, and they happen to be at the right place, right time, right product. And you know what? You know, everyone has their path. So you just got to walk your path the best way you can. And maybe you're destined for greatness, or great things in the way that you think they're great, or maybe you're destined to make a beautiful living doing the art form that you love. And maybe no one will recognize you other than that small audience that loves you. And that is an amazing accomplishment. Or maybe this business isn't for you. And that's a sad reality of what we do. Because as we saw it in the beginning, that punch comes. Either you know how to take it and keep going forward, or you're knocked out. And I've seen a lot of filmmakers get knocked out. And the only goal I have with the show is to make sure that you know that that punch is coming. To let you know that it's coming. Because I wish I had that podcast when you were trying to get this distribution deal.
That's me too. I wish I was listening to this.
I hadn't even started yet. So I was in my own turmoil selling olive oil and vinegar. And that's a whole other conversation for another day. But yeah, okay. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in film business or in life?
I think it goes back to you're not entitled to success. You are not, and that is not entitlement, how good you think you are or how talented you think. You are not entitled to success, and you're not entitled to appreciation, no matter how good you think you are. I think that was a big lesson for me to learn as a younger filmmaker. And even that I'm still trying to have to remind myself of from time to time when, you know, I get into these conversations with filmmakers or producers and I'm like, man, I made two films, mother effer, you know, like I know what I'm doing, but you can't look at it like that. You humble. Have to come into it humble. And so that was a big thing for me is, you know, there are no entitlements here, you know, and you don't deserve any of that. You've got to, even if you're the hardest worker in the, because I also thought it was to do with hard work. I thought if you're the hardest worker in the room and you've got some talent, you know, it will come together. I actually don't think that's true. Like you can do all those things and it's still not come together every time, you know?
What I would say as far as that is concerned, I think if you're the hardest worker in the room and you have a little bit of talent, something will eventually happen.
Yes.
It could happen in a year. It could happen in 10 years. But only good things come from that in one way, shape, or form if you stick with it. That has been my experience. That's been my experience talking to so many filmmakers. If you show up and just keep working every day, something will happen. And I used the example of the podcast. When I launched, nobody knew who I was. No one knew Indie Film Hustle. I came out of it literally from scratch. And I just showed up every day and just did as much work as humanly possible. And I've been able to build up what I've been able to build up over the last 6 years, but purely because of just straight up hustle, man, straight up just grinding and grinding harder than anybody else. And good things do eventually happen, but it takes time to do it. But it might not happen to the way you imagine it in your head. And that is the lesson, because you're not, if you say, oh, I'm going to win the Oscar, you're done. You're done. Pack it up. You're not going to win the Oscar. It's not going to happen. But, you know, like, oh, I'm going to make a million. Maybe. I don't know. Doubtful. Depends on the movie.
Maybe not.
Who knows? But just if you can get out of this, out of what your vision of your success is, and just let it unfold in front of you and be open to whatever comes to you, that I think is a much more better recipe for success than trying to plan this grand thing. Because I promise you, and I've spoken to these guys on the show, every one of them that had these grand things happen to them, not one of them planned it.
And it's such an important distinction, isn't it? Because we're coming in, seeing these people and expecting the same type of success. You know, the Robert Rodriguez, the Kevin Smith. We're going to go that journey. We're going to make these, and it's like, but they didn't have that plan. They're like, I'm just going to make my thing. I got to tell my story and hope that something comes from it, and then all of this stuff came from it. But you know, I think that's, again, goes back to that sort of entitlement thing, right? And you know, what we are adjusting our expectations, because I am sort of very proud of the things that I've done in my career.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of having made two feature films, and I'm super excited to be, you know, just about finishing another one, and all the opportunities that have come with that, all the people I've got to work with along the way, I am incredibly grateful and thankful for that. But it was not, you know, it's not the giddy heights of Hollywood, and that's okay. As you said, that's okay.
I mean, Robert wanted to make a mariachi for the Spanish VHS market. He had no intention of ever it being anywhere else other than straight to video to the Spanish market, not even straight to video American market, straight to video. And look what happened to him. None of them expected. None of them expected. Yeah. Do you think Spielberg expected Jaws to be the beginning of the blockbuster, to be the biggest movie of all time? No, none of them do. So I hope that gets in there. And last question, sir, three of your favorite films of all time.
I mean, this is the hardest one.
But you've had time. You've had time. They're written time. So, they're written down. So let's go.
I've written down and I've cheated. So I'm going to throw out. So my first top three is the three that I can just off the top of my head. The Shining, number one.
Obviously.
Original Star Wars trilogy and Back to the Future. I know that's a cheat, but that would be solid. That would be my another three. The Thing, John Carpenter. The original Indiana Jones trilogy. And the Dollars trilogy. So
you've cheated all sorts in that.
I'm gonna cheat one more set of cheats. Because this is a little bit off the beaten path, because I know that people always give those ones. The Big Lebowski.
Sure.
The Labyrinth. And Before Sunset. The Labyrinth. The Labyrinth.
I don't think Labyrinth has been on the show. Before Sunset, I don't think has either made the list either. But to be fair, you have cheated. So I'm gonna have to disqualify these, sir. I'm sorry. Yeah. But Guy, man, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, man. Thank you so much for being so raw and honest and transparent with your experience, and you know, putting it out there for the world to hear and hopefully help other filmmakers out there. It takes a brave filmmaker to come out and just kind of like, hey man, look, I learned these lessons. Hopefully it's going to help some other people, but I do truly appreciate you coming on the show. And it's been a blast talking to you, my friend. So thank you so much and much success on your journey, sir.
Well, thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me on. I am a cautionary tale for other filmmakers, but I hope that one that people can take a lot and learn from and go, cool, I'm not going to make those mistakes, because we all make mistakes. Making mistakes, what do we take and learn from those? So I really hope people learn from my mistakes. And I'd also just like to say, please go and see my new film, which is available now, Amazon Prime, Tubi, Google Play, which is older. It's free on most of those platforms. And we've been getting some awesome feedback. And, you know, we want to keep making films and long may it continue. So please check that out. And you can also find me on YouTube, The Savage Filmmaker.
Fantastic, man. Thank you again, brother.
Thanks a lot.
I want to thank Guy so much for coming on the show and sharing his journey with us. Thank you so much, Guy. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/479. And don't forget to head over to filmmakerprocess.com. And there you will find a plethora of services that will help you get your film funded, finished, and distributed. And that's at filmmakerprocess.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.